Welcome back to this month's episode of Don't Miss a Beat. I'm here with my friend and colleague, Dr. Muthu Vadugannathan, and I am very excited about this month's episode because we are talking about one of my favorite topics, and that is GDMT for heart failure, and specifically, how do we implement GDMT for heart failure? Now, I think in academic heart failure circles, there's been this growing recognition or movement towards the idea of treating heart failure with the sense of urgency that it deserves. And that includes things like the idea of simultaneous or rapid sequence initiation of our disease-modifying guideline-directed medical therapies. And even the guidelines this past year endorsed the idea of simultaneous initiation of the four pillars for HFrEF and the idea that we need not delay initiation of these medications. You know, but at the same time, I think when you round in the hospital or see patients in the clinic, there oftentimes is this hesitation over how can we possibly start all these medications at the same time? How can we possibly titrate and make so many moves at the same time? And some even point out, well, there's never been a randomized clinical trial directly testing the idea of simultaneous or rapid sequence initiation of GDMT versus the traditional slow and serial approach. But that all changed late last year at the American Heart Conference with the presentation of the STRONG-HF trial. And Muthu, I know you're also very excited about the conversation we're going to have today, but also our very special guest we have with us.
Yeah, thanks so much, Steve. And it's really an understatement of the year that this is your favorite topic to discuss. So you set the stage beautifully, and it's a absolute honor to introduce Dr. Alex Mabaza. Dr. Mabaza is a professor of medicine at University of Paris and an absolute giant in the field of heart failure, but particularly in acute decompensated heart failure and biomarker science. And so it is, and he was the international PI of the STRONG-HF trial. Welcome, Alex. Thank you so much for your time and to be with us today.
Now, I'm really honored to be with both of you. I mean, you're a top expert in the world in this area, and really looking to discuss GDMT and STRONG.
Thank you, Alex. So before we dive in, you know, at least I'm always curious about the origin story. How did trials actually start up? How was the idea initially conceived? And how did you get something like STRONG, which is such an innovative approach, especially when you launched the trial several years ago? How did this come about into fruition?
I think like for the three of us, we were really sad to see many data repeating the same results. I would say maybe the first results is, and Mihai Georgiadi and many others many years ago were just yelling the same thing. When a patient comes out from an acute heart failure, there is no exception. The patient is going to come back. By the way, the nurses knows him by usually her by first name. And after few decompensation, then basically we don't see the patient, or we heard that the patient died. And this is again and again. We not only we see it in our daily practice, but we see it in large database. Then really, I think all of us, we wanted to try to cure this. Now, as you know, for years, I was PI in many trials to try this idea that was now really a stupid idea, which is only giving drugs for 48 hours and think that it may change anything at 90 days or 180 days. We know that this is a failure. And then slowly it appeared to me that you need to give something every morning to try to help those patients surviving. And the second thing that we learned by doing all those trials who unfortunately failed is maybe the target is maybe not necessarily during the acute phase, but maybe we need to wait a little bit that the patient is stabilized and then start as early as possible chronic heart failure therapies. And it's true that I always remember this lady that came to my ICU with a huge pulmonary edema, preserved ejection fraction, because as Steve was mentioning, we have data on and recommendations on reduced ejection fraction. But for me, it was even more horrible when I get patients with a preserved ejection fraction and huge pulmonary edema, and you don't know what to say to the resident and to your fellow, because if you say, I do something, they say, it's written where? Because you spend your week telling them, don't do anything that is not written black on white. And this lady, she did a pulmonary edema. We resolved the congestion. We sent her to the ward. After maybe 1 week or 10 days, she came back with the same pulmonary edema. We sent her back to the ward. She came a third time, and then the third time I told to the fellow, hey guys, this is just not possible. We are going to give her the three therapies. And believe it or not, she never came back, neither to the ICU nor to the cardiology. And then really slowly, I had the conviction that all what we were taught for years, which is to go slowly with the medications. In fact, it's because written in the initial protocol, in the initial trials. But in fact, really in my daily practice, since this lady, I didn't see this happening more than in 50% of the patients, even probably less than that. And then I thought, why don't we do a protocol? Even if 50% of the patient we succeed to have like full therapies, it's already an incredible thing. And then the other half, we will find other solutions. And to answer to Steve's concern about guided, I said it many, many times. Strong was successful because of guided. Really, I mean, it started one day in Paris where Jim presented the results. Indeed, he was sad, and he didn't understand why the results was so negative. And we were several people around the table, and he explained that the number of visits were the same, and guided was not the only one where the target was to reduce NT-proBNP. And then slowly, all of us, we thought maybe we should not use NT-proBNP as a target for efficacy, but maybe we should use it the other way around. We should use it as a target for safety, because I think all of you in your daily practice, you know that in the outpatient center, if the patient goes from 1,000 to 3,000, usually something is wrong. And it works all the time. I mean, you hardly have a patient that is increasing natriuretic peptide and is not being more congested. Then combining this idea that we should use NT-proBNP as a safety measure rather than an efficacy measure, together with this idea I had really from day one, that I did not understand why a cancer patient, if the diagnosis is done Monday, the following Monday, oncologist, everybody was around the table, decide the therapies, and Tuesday the patient had the therapy. And why heart failure? Everybody knows that we wait months, years, and the patient dies. And I don't know why I had always this idea in mind that this is unfair.
Yeah, I mean, so many wise words there, Alex. I mean, point really resonates too. I mean, you're talking to your trainee and they're so used to hearing across all their different rotations, the idea of usually with medications, okay, go slow, you know, do no harm is the first mantra that we learn oftentimes in medical school. But at the same time, we're not really considering the risks of omission for a lot of these medications. And as you mentioned, the fact that, you know, patients aren't going to actually get on these medications when we look at the data over and over and over again, and it's just so depressing. So why don't you walk us through the study population for strong, the how you designed the high intensity and the usual care arms, and just the patient population?
Yeah, maybe before I go to the patient population, maybe another thing we learned from guided also, and also from our daily practice, from the survey that both of you did and studies that you did, and this was also something that I felt very important, is what the physician should do during an outpatient visit. Because, I mean, let's tell the truth. I mean, in our hospitals, we know that when the patient comes, we shake hands, we say, oh, we are so happy to see you. How is your dyspnea? No, I'm just fine. Okay, we see you in 3 months. I mean, you agree. I mean, no, nothing else. I mean, basically, The patient is happy, we are happy, and see you. And then really, I think this maybe it's one of the important points of Strong is we said, okay, the visit, we are going to tell exactly to the physician exactly what he is going to do. And maybe this was also an important point. Then to come back to the patients, indeed, I think we are all trialists. What you try to do is you try to optimize and enrich the population to make sure that the action that you are going to do will show any benefit. And in fact, when we looked on the surveys, we saw that, and you know it by heart, that many patients were leaving the hospital with a congestion. Many are leaving the hospital with a high natriuretic peptide level. And by chance or not by chance, those patients are often the patients who have no oral medications because people are scared that if they give them oral medication, they will compensate them again. I mean, this is really the theory that was said by many people in textbooks, etc. And then the population was really patients with an NT-proBNP higher than 1,500. But as you can see in the paper, they are much higher than that before being discharged. We are talking about the last NT-proBNP before being discharged. And those guys were going to be discharged. And it's incredible. I mean, NT-proBNP is high sky. And say, no, but he's not dyspneic. Let's send him back home. And indeed, we took patients that had either beta blocker or ACE, not the two. And indeed, at a low dose. Then we felt that those patients, because we looked on databases like RELAX, like other databases to see whether the number of events will be enough to extract the difference. And then the combination of high natriuretic peptide and the lack of therapies showed that we had enough event expected, at least. Then concerning the two arms, indeed, like we heard after we presented the results, you could not believe how many people were just yelling on us when we said we are going to do a standard of care. We are just going to send the patient and cardiologist in town. Indeed, I can tell you, everybody is saying that they are never doing this. No. We are never doing this. Well, sometimes some centers I had to go there to say, okay, you are doing well, but the guy in box one, box three, box four, what are they doing? We know, come on. And because the heart failure clinics are busy, because we are short of physicians, we are short of nurses. I mean. And then we said, okay, standard of care is just you do a medical report, very, very good medical report, and you send it to the cardiologist in town. And the other arm, we thought to give half before being discharged. For me, it was really important. Really, safety was really our anxiety from day one, is that we felt that maybe we were doing a mistake here. And then I felt much more comfortable to have half of the dose in the hospital, because then anyone can see if the combination, it's not so much the dose, but the combination of the three may harm the patient. After many discussions, We did not know in the beginning whether we should see the patient every 2 weeks, etc. And again, I was so much anxious about safety. I said, no. 1 week after, we need to see the patient because we never know, and the study can be stopped if we are really stupid. And it's true that we are courageous to say week two we go up. We had a long discussion. Many members of the steering committee felt that we should really do it much later. And again, we have no data, but I felt in my experience in putting all those safety visits around, we should be okay. And maybe more importantly, we made the cardiologist feel comfortable with the procedure. And we said, please, at week two, if all the lights are on the green, you have no other way to go out. You need to increase one, two, or three drugs up to 100%. However, if you see this or this or this, no, we are not asking for heroes here. Just you wait at half. The only thing we said, never go down below half. Because I think the literature, you may have seen this paper of Caroline Lam and Lancet, Adrian Wurst, many papers from you guys. You see that really half is really the minimum to be efficient and really. Maybe it's the only thing I was fighting for is never go below a half, because I felt we need really a little bit of efficacy. And we told them, you do whatever you want between half and full, but if the lights are on the green, there is no issue. You go up to 100%. And we gave this third visit at 1 week later, week three. We added this week six again because we felt we need to make sure that there will be no issue. And by the way, I think we did well because I think one quarter of the patients still change medication in both directions. Papers will come out and you will see this. And then 90 days, we saw all the patients. And it's interesting to see, I don't know if you pay attention, but in the standard of care, since it's the same investigators that saw the patient of the high intensity care arm, when someone from the standard of care arm, usual care arm, was coming at day 90, the guys were trained over months to do the maximum. Then when they saw them, they boosted many things. And this reason why at 90 days, or at least at 180 days, you see between 90 days and 180 days in the usual care arm, you see spironolactone is increasing like hell. Because again, and I think this was the problem of guided, as you know, you cannot the same morning have two patients in two different boxes and two different arms and think that your brain will do differently. And we see it very well and strong. We see that at day 90, the physicians were happy to see the usual care. And I can tell you they gave them all what is needed. And despite the fact that between 90 days and 180 days, the physicians did something at 90 days, despite this, we at 180 days, we kept seeing difference.
Yes, fascinating observations, and especially related to that last discussion around potential contamination. But despite that contamination, you were able to show an overwhelming result in terms of not just medical optimization, but also in terms of efficacy outcomes. I was also particularly impressed that this was a global trial and you successfully enrolled in regions that traditionally have been quite underrepresented in previous pivotal randomized clinical trials in heart failure, including about 20% enrollment in Africa, which did support the diversity of the population and perhaps the generalizability to different settings. I was also impressed, and you noted this, how high those NT-proBNP levels were. You noted that at discharge, they were quite high. And in fact, the average NT-proBNP was above 4,000, which is markedly elevated. And at screening and initial contact, they were above 7,000. So this is really quite a sick population and may help us translate ultimately who we offer this type of high intensity support to is perhaps our sickest patients at highest risk for disease progression, those with highest NT-proBNP levels. We all saw the top line findings of the trial that the DSMB stopped the trial early for overwhelming efficacy for all-cause mortality or heart failure hospitalization. I want to draw our attention to safety because that's really a key element here in terms of strong. And so how do you interpret the safety related to between the two arms? I believe you showed that overall adverse events were higher in high intensity group, but there was no difference in serious adverse events. And so talk to us about how safety events were captured and how you interpret those data.
Yeah, thank you for this question, because as I told you, really, you could not believe, but for years, my level of anxiety was very high because of safety, because at the end of the day, is patients, is our patients. We hope that one of the papers that we are going to work on and submit in the next months is to see what I name the learning curve. Because in fact, when we did the first 350 patients, we hardly saw difference in rehospitalization. If anything, in the first patients, we saw it in the other way around. We saw more events. Then I think it's interesting to have a paper where we can show to the trialist how the final results, how it did move over the time, and more importantly, how the hazard ratio moved when we will put all the centers starting the same day one, you know, with the first patient included. But clearly there was a learning curve, and the learning curve in the beginning was clearly having you were having a little bit more safety concern. Now, the fatal adverse event are usually mortality and readmission. If the final primary endpoint is positive, I think it makes sense that one was not so much difference. We had more adverse effect because, again, as you said, patients were severe at the end of the day. Then we had hypotension, we had an increase in potassium, we have increase in creatinine, we have a few things like this. But again, I think strong is not the answer to 100% of heart failure patients. If we accept that 50 to 100% is already a success, not 50-50-50, but let's say combining 50 and 100%, I think for me it's already a success. But then our job by analyzing the data set is to see what patients, I mean, could we predict during the hospitalization for which patients the procedure will not work and we will need more time, or for which patients the procedure will be just half, and we will not go from there. Because at the end of the day, and we hope to show, I don't know, but I think if the patient is really severe, and instead of having really nothing because hypotension or hyperkalemia, if you can give him half, I think we can prevent some episodes. We need to show it indeed. Then when the results came out, I thought, okay, the adverse event is a little bit the price to pay, but I think we should not see it like that. We should see a subgroup of patients who will go through without adverse event. And some patients, if we can predict that they are going to do the adverse event, then we go for like a plan B from the beginning.
Alex, I wanted to ask you a question that I've already had, you know, my own institution with others, is the idea of, well, how do we implement the strong HF protocol, you know, in our routine practice? You know, it's 4 visits within 6 weeks. You know, in the trial, those were primarily by cardiologists with a training in heart failure. But at the same time, you know, we just were, you know, in the COVID pandemic still, and hopefully we're through the worst of that. But we've gotten used to the idea of, well, you know, potentially virtual care and remote titration. And, you know, also with Strong, we, you know, conveniently had that NT-proBNP, you know, which is just a lab test, not necessarily a face-to-face visit in and of itself, of course, to kind of work in from a safety perspective. So I don't know, do you have any practical tips or just thoughts on how you see, you know, strong HF being rolled out in the real world here?
Can I ask a question, Steve? Sure. if you have a patient, let's even not talk about the preserved ejection fraction, which I think it's maybe one of the most important results of strong. But yourself, if you have a gentleman, 60 years old, with an ejection fraction at 30%, even stable, how many times a year you would see him?
Roughly. So it depends if I think they're on maximally tolerated GDMT. I'll be quite frank with you. If I think they're already on truly maximally tolerated medications and, you know, they're stable on that, that's a different story besides they're stable on low doses or missing pillars. So
sure. But you agree if they're on low dose, yeah, you see them how many times a year? 4 times?
So I personally end up having to call my patients a lot, and I do a lot of titration things over the phone, to be quite frank.
Sure. But lab checks. Did you calculate
how many? In person, you're right. In person, it's very hard to see someone, you know, more than 4, even 6 times in the clinic a year. Yeah. But I totally understand the in-person stuff is hard from a scheduling perspective.
Yeah, then what? Because when I came back to France, I can tell you already in the airplane, people are saying, "Alex, you are crazy. I have no time." But in fact, it's not like this. If you have a patient, as you said, with a minimal dose that you will call many times, that you will see 3 or 4 times a year. In fact, why don't we spread this thing? Then why don't we put everything together, all the visits together? It's easier for the nurses. It's easier to understand to the patient. And we say, hey, what we do is we see you four times, and even I not even talking about nurses, just for cardiologists, you see him four times on a weekly basis, and then at following week six, and then you already have a big chance to be for all the drugs between 50% and 100%. Then this is today my answer. And if after those four visits, as you said, if the patient is between 75% and 100% for all the medications, why do you see him again? And basically, you don't need. I mean, this patient is just better than you and me. Then we don't need. Then the idea is really to concentrate all those visits after a decompensated heart failure or whenever you decide that it's time to do the strong procedure. And the other comment, yeah, totally right. We need to involve nurses, because all what we are putting in the procedure could be done by nurses, and she can call you. I mean, potassium, creatinine, and NT-proBNP, blood pressure, heart rate, and the level of edema. Really, it's very easy to do, and then you can do together. I mean, between her and you. And as you said, the third option is, and we have a paper that we are going to submit soon, a study that we did in Tunisia, where half of the visits were done by a nurse at home. Then the nurse was going with a device to measure NT-proBNP, and she was giving us exactly the parameters. She was taking a little bit of blood. When she was arriving in the hospital, she was doing a potassium and creatinine. NT-proBNP was done inside just for the patient to see that he's improving or not. And the results is as good as strong.
Oh, so thank you so much, Alex. I think there's so much to digest with this trial. It is so innovative, not only in the design and conduct, but I think in terms of the implications to practice, it's really launched an entire set of implementation strategies that are going to be required to achieve what you saw in STRONG-HF and fully realize it in practice. And I think the next years are going to be very exciting as investigators, researchers, clinicians digest STRONG-HF and hopefully improve the care of the global heart failure population. I'd like to thank you again, Alex.
Hi, thank you. It was really a nice conversation. Thank you so much for the invitation.
And so that's it for this episode of Don't Miss a Beat. Remember, you can find Don't Miss a Beat on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and HCP Live Cardiology, your home for the latest clinically relevant news and information impacting cardiology. Thanks again, everyone.